Well, good morning, Connecticut, to our friends across the Sound. Happy New Year. Welcome to our first broadcast of the award-winning For the People for 2018. It's John Boquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. And this is the award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're going to open with a representative of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness, talking about the particular challenges that homeless residents are having during this protracted Arctic cold snap that we've been having, and about how you can help this agency with two important data-gathering census activities coming up in the next few weeks. Then we're going to talk to Connecticut's Consumer Council about the FCC's recent repeal of net neutrality rules. Why does this matter to you? And what is net neutrality anyway? Stay tuned for a crash course and learn what Connecticut and many other states and partners are trying to do about it. Then we'll close talking with IRIS Connecticut, Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services, to hear about the work our state's largest refugee resettlement network is doing and how you can help by participating with thousands of others in the agency's run for refugees on Super Bowl Sunday. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Boquette, right after this reminder. Wheeler's Clinic's foster care program is hosting two upcoming information sessions for prospective foster parents from 11 a.m. to noon on January 13th in Plainville and January 27th in Waterbury. Mature adults who are single or married or working at home are encouraged to stop by a session and learn about foster care opportunities. You don't have to make a commitment of any kind. Families are part of a team of professionals and are provided with financial support and training to ensure they're well-equipped to meet the needs of the youth in their care. For information about these sessions and other foster care opportunities, you can go to wheelerclinic.org. That's W-H-E-E-L-E-R clinic.org. Well, I know a lot of people have been really thinking and talking about the cold lately and the weather, but I'm not sure that it impacts anyone more than the growing number of homeless individuals, and in particular, the ones we worry about the most, the ones that are most physically compromised, especially the families, the single mothers who might be out there with their kids, couch jumping or sleeping in their cars or even on the street. We're here today with Madeline Ravitch. She's the development advisor for the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. In partnership with members and communities throughout the state, the coalition creates change through leadership, advocacy, and building the capacity of members and the field to respond to environmental changes. Their mission is to prevent and end homelessness in Connecticut. We'll find out how they're doing and the roles that you might be able to play in your community and here in Connecticut. Madeline, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, tell us a little bit as we record this on Friday of the deep freeze here at the end of the first week of January. We've been experiencing an unusual cold snap, and it looks like it's bound to, for the most part, continue at least into the next week or so. And obviously, we're going to have cold weather in through the springtime here in Connecticut. What are you hearing from your agencies and the front lines right now in terms of the cold and how our communities are doing in terms of accommodating people that might normally try to weather it out if it's in the 20s or 30s, but once it gets down below zero, it becomes quite a bit more dangerous?
Absolutely. Well, I think the first thing to know is that there are warming centers open around the state. The governor instituted a cold weather protocol, and so if you are out there and are on the street or in our cold, or if you know people who are, do encourage them to call 211 so that they can help them connect with resources and with places that they can come inside. And what we're doing year round is really trying to make sure that we're getting people to come inside and get into housing, which is where we believe everybody should be in the first place. So it's great that people are thinking about this, but it is a year round problem. But right now it's especially important to help people know that they can call 211 and be connected with help if they need it.
And for folks that are listening that have the wherewithal or the ability to do something to help, what would you recommend is the best way that an individual can, without a lot of process, make a significant difference, whether it's a donation of some warm clothing, food, even money, or volunteer time. Can you make a couple of recommendations on some ideas for them?
Absolutely. Well, so obviously there are shelters all around the state that are members of our coalition looking for volunteers, for donors, and for help to be able to have the resources to help help people they serve stay warm in this weather. I did want to talk about a few different opportunities that are really current right now and are very much in need of volunteers. One of which is the point in time count, which is the annual count of the homeless population. It's really a census that is led by volunteers. And so we and our coalition and all the different agencies look to volunteers like the people who may be listening today to come out. This year it'll take place the evening of January 23rd. And so you can, if you get in touch with us, we can connect you with your local point in time count, and you'll go out with a team of people to survey the population of people who are out there on the streets. And that's really, that data that comes out of that is so important to help us get resources to help people in the future. We also have a homeless youth count. So for people who want to volunteer, sometimes that this can be during the day or the evening. The point in time count is just the evening. We're looking for volunteers from the week of January 24th through 30th to join people in their communities and going out on teams and doing a census of youth who are outside or couch surfing.
We're having a little bit of a signal issue with you. Did you say it's a youth census?
Yeah, so there are actually two censuses. One is the point in time count, which is the evening of January 23rd.
Right.
That's an annual count that happens actually all around the country. We mm-hmm. coordinate it for the state of Connecticut. And so that is really people who are out on the streets that one cold night in January. So that's January 23rd. We also, because youth were not showing up in that census, created an alternate youth count to really focus on looking for youth in hot spots where we know homeless youth congregate. And so we're looking for volunteers for that count, which will take place January 24th through 30th. So that is volunteering at some point during that 1 week, which is not coincidentally around the same time as the point in time count.
So could you give folks a little bit of an idea of what they would expect if they've never done this before, or they do want to get involved as a volunteer for either the week-long census or the one-night point-in-time count?
Sure. Well, these two counts involve volunteers going out in teams. So you'd come for a short training on how to administer the survey, and then hit the streets in a team led generally by somebody who's pretty seasoned in the field, going out and surveying. In the case of the point in time count, the census block been assigned. In the case of the homeless youth count, hot spots and in community settings, and obviously dressed warmly if you do volunteer. We'll, of course, for anybody who volunteers, let you know what you need to know in advance of the night or day you show up. But definitely dress warmly because you'll be out in the streets talking to people and surveying and collecting important information. But it is not warm out
Great.
There.
Very good. So folks can go to your website, CCEH, for the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. That's CCEH.org/volunteer. Or visit BeHomeful.org to learn more about the Homeful Project, which we're going to talk about next. But CCEH.org to learn about the organization, put a /volunteer after it if you want to go right to the volunteer page, and you can learn more about the details and getting involved in the training and such. Madeline Ravitch is with us. She's the development advisor for the Connecticut Coalition and Homelessness, working harder than ever on these coldest of days here in Connecticut, extended cold. into the week, and we hope that folks out there who are homeless are utilizing the warming centers or are finding a place for themselves and their families, as we know and have talked to the coalition and many other representatives about over the past few years here on the award-winning For the People, a much greater and growing population of homeless youths aged 13 to 24 that are out on the street. So we hope those folks are getting the help they need. Certainly opportunities for you listeners to get involved in supporting the organization and the great work that they do across Connecticut. Speaking of great work, great partners come in the form of the Connecticut Realtors Foundation, Citizens Bank, and United Way. The coalition's Be Homeful for the Holidays is has just wrapped up, but there's still a lot more to learn. Madeline, tell us about Be Homeful for the Holidays.
Sure. Well, so this is part of a wonderful program that we started a few years ago called the Be Homeful Project, which raises emergency funds to help families in shelter. We actually are seeing a decline in family homelessness in our state, and a big part of that is the Be Homeful Project, which raises money for shelter diversion, which is funds to help families stay in their homes. And remarkably, it is possible to help families stay in their homes for on average $1,000 if we can really intercept them when they're right at the front door of homelessness and think they're out of options. A lot of the time, our frontline workers can sort of help them walk it back and explore alternatives. And this funding really helps with that. So this holiday season, this was our second year of a great promotion we've been doing called Be Homeful for the Holidays, where people out there are able to donate a Paddington Bear or this year book to a child in a shelter. And thanks to sponsors, which include the Connecticut Realtors Foundation, which sponsored the Bears, and Citizens Bank and United Way, the funds were able to go to the Be Homeful Project, and they paid for the merchandise. So so your money doesn't actually go towards the merchandise, which is great. So right before the holidays is what this wonderful thing happened, which is the Connecticut Realtors, Citizens Bank, and volunteers from those two organizations joined together to deliver the bears and books to 48 shelters around the state to make sure that each one of the 800 children who were going to spend their holidays in shelter would be able to get their very own Paddington Bear or book. And so that was a wonderful thing. And we still are looking for people to hold bear raisers during the wintertime. It's a great opportunity for businesses, for congregations, for community groups, to really kind of roll up their sleeves and do something fun and exciting, but also something that's really important because every one of those bears or books raised not only ends up in the hands of a child, but also raises money that we really need to be able to help families stay in their homes. And then another opportunity tied in with that is really at the heart of this campaign, the Be Homeful Project, is our Paddington ambassadors, which are the kids who volunteer with us. There's nobody more empathetic than kids, and kids really understand that we really need to be in it together to help families in our communities stay housed.
Yeah.
And so kids can sign up to be Paddington ambassadors. Learn about homelessness using materials which include Paddington's story, because he was homeless at the start of his story.
Mm-hmm.
And then hold marmalade drives, because Paddington loves marmalade, to help families stay in their homes. And a lot of kids are doing Valentine's Day drives now and making Valentine's for kids in shelters while also holding their drives. So we're looking for kids to be leaders. And, you know, these kids can be anywhere as young as preschool all the way up to high school. We love high schoolers and middle schoolers because they can really kind of run with this and really be leaders in their community in ending homelessness to make sure that no child in their community has to be homeless.
Mm. What are the ways that the young people can get in touch and get involved? Does it have to have a parent involvement, or do they have to be part of a group, or is this something that they do on their own?
Well, younger kids obviously often do it with their families. Older kids can really sign up to be leaders in their school. They can leave their schools, they can leave their community groups, but we have older kids who kind of volunteer a little bit more independently, although parents often usually do know what's involved or involved in one way or another. But it is a great opportunity for kids' leadership, for family leadership. And the connection with Paddington Bear, in case it's not obvious, is that Paddington was homeless at the start of his journey before the Browns saw it in their hearts to take him in. And with Paddington 2, the movie coming out on January 12th, it's a time where people really are thinking about Paddington, and we hope that they'll also be thinking about how they can join Paddington in making a difference in their community.
Very good. In the last couple of minutes that we have with you, Madeline Ravitch, tell us a little bit more about what's in store for the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Once the point in time count on January 23rd is completed, as well as the second statewide census of unstably housed and homeless youth aged 13 to 24, the week of January 25th, obviously the data gathering and crunching and ensuing reports are going to be important. But as we move into the later winter months and even into the spring, are there any other major events or activities that the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness is engaged in on a statewide basis?
Well, our organization and our coalition really is working statewide year-round to help individuals and families. So people think about homelessness during the cold months, and that makes perfect sense, but homelessness is very much a year-round issue. In fact, family homelessness peaks in the summertime when kids let out of school and parents are struggling with the cost of daycare, childcare. I think that homelessness is a year-round problem. Our coalition is working year-round to identify people who are facing homelessness and connect them with resources in their communities so that they can be housed. So it really is a year-round effort. You can get involved with our coalition. You can join our coalition at cch.org/volunteer. At the bottom, there's a section for how to join the coalition, and we really love that sort of show of solidarity of people showing that this is really a movement to end homelessness. You can also sign up for our CCH newsletter to find out what's happening in the communities around the state. But it's a real year-round issue, which requires year-round, day in, day out work from the frontline providers who are out there every day helping people who are in need. And again, for people who are in need, we do tell them to call 211, which is the United Way's front door to the shelter system, so they can connect with those frontline workers who will help them figure out how to connect with the resources they need to stay housed or to get housed, get rehoused.
Excellent. Madeline Ravitch, Development Advisor for the Connecticut Coalition and Homelessness. Folks, we apologize for the little bit of audio issues we're having. We're taping this on this 50-mile-an-hour wind gust day where it's playing a little havoc on the signal line. So stick with us for the rest of the program. The Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness provides emergency support, training, technical assistance, leadership development, community connections, advocacy, strategic communications, research and analysis. They engage more than 75 members, shelters, providers, transitional housing organizations, communities, business leaders, and other strategic partners who share the goal of ending homelessness here in Connecticut. In partnership with communities throughout the state, the coalition advances this goal through leadership, community organizing, advocacy, research, and education. Madeline, thank you so much for being part of the program this morning, and hopefully we'll get a good turnout for you folks for both the point in time count as well as the youth census. Thanks again for being on the show. CCEH.org is their website. Well, our next guest has elevated herself to one of my favorites so far because, you call the governor's office, you get gatekeepers. You call the Department of Transportation, you get gatekeepers. You call Connecticut Consumer Council, Ellen Swanson-Katz, and Ellen Swanson-Katz answers the phone.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very nice, John.
That's great. You're one of the only people in the entire state hierarchy who I call at the office, and you answer your own phone. The other ones, I have to text first, or call on the cell, or call at home. So this is great. Yeah. So we've had you on before, and your predecessors as well. For folks who may not be exactly familiar with what the niche in the large quilt work of Connecticut agencies that the Consumer Council fills, can you just give folks a little reminder of exactly what you do and what your agency does for them?
Of course. Well, I'm the Consumer Council for the state of Connecticut, which means I'm head of a very small, like 11 people, independent state agency that is charged with representing consumers on issues relating to electricity, natural gas, water, and telecommunications. So it's our job to be the voice of the people in rate cases, in policymaking, at the federal level, in state court, on anything related to those sort of four utility issues. We work directly for the people and on behalf of the people, so we do try to be accessible, and I appreciate the kind words from you.
Yeah, and it sounds like due to what the areas of attention that are on your radar, you must, I don't say bump up against in a negative way, but you must interface heavily with PURA.
Oh, absolutely. We're actually located in the same building as the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority. And in fact, we are, whenever there's a case before PURA, what we call a docket, it's an administrative proceeding, we are automatically a party to that. Every docket before PURA, and then we are the only agency that has statutory authority to appeal PURA decisions to court as a matter of right. So we really have a lot of responsibility on behalf of the people, and we take that really that responsibility quite seriously and are really mission-driven here.
Good. Well, the bulk of our remaining discussion is going to be talking about net neutrality and the reaction that you had right before the Christmas holidays when the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, repealed net neutrality rules. But before we get into that conversation, Ellen, is there anything else of significance right now on the radar for the Consumer Council that you're concerned that consumers either may not be as aware of as they should, or are something you might be interested in promoting to help engage more consumers in the areas that you handle?
Sure. Well, I would always urge consumers to go to our website, which is ct.gov/OCC, or to just, you put in Consumer Council Connecticut and you come to our website, and we try really hard to keep the content fresh. I also have a Twitter feed, which is at Ellen Katz. And so we try to be pushing information out to consumers, and we really want to interact with consumers as well. And I guess the only, there's a million things, but the thing that strikes me as might be of interest to people is the new tax laws that were just passed are actually going to have a very significant impact on utility rates, because utility consumers pay basically the corporate taxes of the utility companies. And so a reduction in those taxes will have a reduction in rates, direct corollary. And so that is a process that we are in the middle of with PURA, and assessing those impacts will be going on for the next couple months. But that's a change in the positive direction for consumers and rates. And, I know Connecticut has some of the highest electric rates in the country, and we continue to do everything we can to keep rates as reasonable as possible. Anytime I can pass on good news, I like to be able to do that.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you said that, because aren't the at least one or the electrical utilities in the process right now of going through for hearings and things for a rate potential
a rate increase? Yeah, Eversource our largest utility, has a what we call a rate application pending for a 3-year rate increase. And just to give you an idea of the scope of the magnitude of the impact of the tax requirements, their first-year request, sort of the opening salvo in their rate application, was for $255 million rate increase for the first year for 2018. And our back-of-the-envelope impact of the tax changes would reduce that right off the bat by $45 million, so reduce the revenue requirements. So, it's a big deal, and we are going to follow that. It's happening all over the country where PUCs and advocates and utility companies are all working to assess the impact.
Mm. And so does the fluid nature of the impact of the federal tax initiative, does that come into play on a day-to-day basis as these hearings kind of proceed?
Well, just to give you a little inside baseball, we have been negotiating a settlement with Eversource, which we expect to file next week, and there will be hearings on that. But we are anticipating that in that settlement document that we file, there will be the impact of the tax reductions will be laid out. So in a matter of days, folks will be able to look at it and say, oh, here's where the negotiations landed, and here's the additional impact of these rate reductions, of these tax reductions.
Very good. Excellent. Yeah. Folks, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Ellen Swanson Katz. I'm sorry. She's the Connecticut Consumer Council. CT.gov/OCC is her website. And if you're tweeting, it's at Ellen Katz. That's ELINKATZ, right?
Yes.
Very good. Well, the subject at hand today is the conversation, at least, is a result of a release that I received just before the holidays regarding Commissioner Katz and her reaction to the Federal Communications Commission decision to repeal net neutrality rules, indicating initially that repealing net neutrality is going to harm consumers and businesses and stifle innovation. And we want to kind of touch on each of those three aspects. But before we do that, Ellen, if you wouldn't mind, please just kind of let people know, the elevator conversation on net neutrality and what the big deal was, why the FCC suddenly went after this subject and, kind of seemed to just throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah, I'm happy to explain it. In fact, at Christmas dinner, my whole family was there and said, could you explain net neutrality, what it is? And so it's on everyone's mind. So the concept of net neutrality, just so everyone has sort of the same basis for starting the conversation, is if you think of the internet as this information superhighway, like imagine a giant highway with information flowing back and forth on it, you get access to that information through what are called internet service providers. These are sort of the on and off ramps, right? So you have to, in Connecticut, you have to have Frontier or Comcast or Cablevision or Altice, one of the companies that allows you to access the internet. Mm-hmm. And net neutrality is a concept enforced that, according to rules that were put in place a couple years ago by the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, that said ISPs, internet service providers, must provide fair, equal, and unfettered access to all websites. They couldn't create essentially fast lanes that get you to certain websites faster than others. They couldn't throttle, which is, in other words, slow down the traffic going to particular websites, and they couldn't block. There may be reasons why a company might want to block access to a competitor's website. Mm-hmm. And so that is the concept to me of a free and open and equal internet where when we access it, we all know we're getting the same speed access to any website. So you can access the website for a company selling blueberry jam in Maine as quickly as you can access the Amazon website. Okay. That's what net neutrality means.
So let me just interrupt you there for a moment. Up until a couple of years ago. Was this happening and that necessitated the action that has just been repealed?
Now remember, we're talking about an industry that's really in its infancy, even though it's been around like 10 years at this point.
Sure.
Yes. So prior to that, there were no net neutrality rules, but there were beginnings of indications that companies were going to start, were engaging in some throttling and some slowing down, and there were some lawsuits around that, actually. Believe it or not, when, say, your and these rules would also apply to wireless carriers as well.
Okay.
So, for example, there was one company that was giving you free access to YouTube, let's say, as part of your package. That's actually giving preferential treatment to a website. So that's actually a violation of net neutrality because they're saying, you know, we're going to make it really easy for you to go look at YouTube videos. And so that actually did spawn some lawsuits. So that's one example of sort of an unequal access to the Internet. And folks might say, well, gee, but I want the option to watch free YouTube videos. I know I'm making that choice.
Right.
The problem becomes, I think, much more difficult is if you look at the contracts that you sign when you are signing up with, you know, one of your cable provider or your telecommunications provider.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're small and they're dense, and you might not know that you're only signing up for a limited package that gives you access to, you know, limited access to Google and social media. But they could start offering that as a potential package now under with the repeal of the net neutrality rules. I think what I see as the sort of insidious harm is it means that your ISP could charge extra to create fast lanes, and so therefore a big company like Amazon could well afford to pay extra to, when you search in, type in, you know, blueberry jam, to start with my example, you get to Amazon first, and it comes, and it's much quicker if you want to buy something than if you want to go to the main blueberry jam company. And so you can see how the bigger, the big companies that can afford to pay extra would gain the advantage, and that's why one of my real concerns is I think this is a small business problem in a lot of ways, because we know in Connecticut there's a lot of companies, there's a lot of people who basically operate small businesses out of their homes or out of their garages, and a lot of interesting innovation in that area. But if they can't compete on a fair and equal basis with the big guys, then we're going to see big small companies really getting squashed, particularly startups.
Very good. We're going to take a quick break. Ellen Swanson Katz is with us. She's the Connecticut Consumer Council. Aside from our little introductory conversation, we're now deep into a talk about her concerns over the repeal of net neutrality rules. We're going to take just a few moments. Stick with us. We'll come back and talk with Ellen Swanson Katz more about net neutrality here, why it's anti-consumer, and how it's going to potentially stifle innovation. Stick with us. We'll be right back. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through LoveCT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click onto LoveCT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this. The Community Foundation for Greater New Haven has just announced two grant opportunities with application deadlines looming. The Community Fund for Women and Girls is accepting applications for the 2018 grant cycle through Thursday, January 18th, to help underwrite gender-specific initiatives that are intentional, equitable, and well-informed. Also, the Quinnipiac River Fund, a component fund of the Community Foundation, is accepting applications through Monday, January 22nd for projects designed to benefit the environmental quality of the Quinnipiac River, the New Haven Harbor, and surrounding watersheds. Approximately $100,000 in grants are awarded each spring from this fund. For more information, just head to the foundation's website to get started by clicking on cfgnh.org. All right. We're back with Ellen Swanson Katz. She is the Connecticut Consumer Counsel. Back before the holidays, the Federal Communication Commission repealed net neutrality rules, and one of the first and loudest voices of opposition to that was our Connecticut Consumer Counsel, who's on the line with us right now. So, Ellen, we were talking about the concerns that you had with consumers and businesses, but one of the other issues that you were concerned about was that it would be stifling innovation. Can you talk a little bit about your concerns in that department?
Sure, absolutely. Well, we know a lot of the innovation that comes around, I mean, there's like 89% of new businesses in the country are small businesses. And small businesses sort of, I think, have thrived, particularly in the global economy, because they have an even chance with the big businesses. So all of a sudden, you have a great idea, you can throw it up on the internet, you can do Kickstarter campaign, you can, you know, there's all these really cool, innovative ways to get new ideas before the public. And so we've seen that. I mean, look at the way our economy has changed, our whole culture has changed in a matter of years because of, you know, let's say a small startup like Snapchat that someone thought of, or a new company that has thrown up a product that all of a sudden everybody wants access to. What net neutrality can do, as I was saying before the break, is it can allow your ISP, Internet Service Provider, to charge more to access certain websites. And so if you are a small business with the latest, greatest new idea, by definition, you probably don't have a whole lot of money. So you're not going to be able to pay extra to the ISP to get consumers to your website. So, you know, if you could think of it as like you're on the New Jersey Turnpike and they have the local lane and they have the express lane, if you're putting all the big companies on the express lane and you can go really fast to them and it's quick, but it's harder and slower. And it's slower, we mean throttled. I mean, they literally will slow down the ability for you to reach a particular website. That's when we see this innovation being stifled. And ultimately, the reason I say it's anti-consumer is because any time that a company is charging more for a service, it gets passed on to the consumer. So going back to my Amazon example, if the ISP like Comcast or Frontier or whomever is charging Amazon extra to get to their website first, then that cost ultimately gets passed on to consumers as well. So we see a stifling of innovation. We see costs going up. And, you know, I'm concerned about innovation and free speech and the ability for everyone to have equal access to the internet. And so, you know, that's why this has been a real alarm for so many people who engage in this space.
Well, aside from putting people on the internet, the other thing that ISPs are really good for is making a lot of money. Have you seen evidence of any of them already? I mean, literally, as soon as the switch was flipped by the FCC to throw out the net neutrality rules, did you hear about or start to see developments that would bring your worst fears to fruition?
We have not seen that yet. In fact, there's been such public outcry over this, and that's, to me, another thing that's alarming. The public is overwhelmingly in support of net neutrality rules, and nonetheless, the FCC went ahead and repealed them. You know, to me, that's the government is not reflecting the will of the people in this instance. And because of the tremendous pushback, we've seen companies who have said, oh, no, you know, like Comcast says, oh, no, we're not going to throttle and we're not going to create preferential lanes. But that's today. And, you know, in 6 months from now, who knows what could happen. And you can look at other countries where they don't have the same sort of free and even access to the internet that we have. And the packages almost start to look like what we've seen in cable TV, where, you know, you can pay a basic fee and maybe you'll only get, you know, Netflix and basic access to limited
Limited
Google
local
searches,
program.
Right?
Yeah,
but you want a premium plan if you want to access Netflix and Amazon. And so those are, you know, we're just worried about the tipping point because there's a tremendous opportunity for economic power here, and monopolistic behavior. And with all the mergers in the utility industry, I think we all look around and see companies getting bigger and bigger in general. You worry about the concentration of economic power in the hands of a few.
Aside from you, who shouted pretty loud when this all went down back in mid-December, one of the other folks who you talk about in your release is Washington State Governor Jay Inslee, who you indicate had some great ideas about responding to this issue.
And there's a lot of state and local leaders who have stepped out on this, and I want to talk about what Connecticut's doing as well. But the Washington governor said we should all get together and use the economic power of our states to demand that the ISPs keep their commitments not to block websites, to throttle speeds, or to impose what we call prioritization pricing, and to leverage the state's power as a large purchaser of telecommunication services to say, we're only going to do state contracts with people who abide by net neutrality rules. And this is a number that we've looked at before. The state of Connecticut spends tens of millions of dollars on telecommunication services, right? So if we banded together with a lot of other states and said, you know, listen, we're going to create a buying block, and we're only going to buy from companies that promise to abide by net neutrality rules, that's a tremendous way to make sure we're protecting the market.
Mm-hmm. So what are we going to be doing here in Connecticut to try to hedge against this and protect our consumers, businesses, and protect innovation?
Yeah, well, it's my understanding that the state of Connecticut, which led by Attorney General George Stepson, there's been a lawsuit filed against the FCC for imposing, repealing the net neutrality rules, and we will be joining it. Federal agencies can't just willy-nilly change rules because they feel like it, because you can imagine as administrations change, businesses and consumers could be subject to, you know, being whipsawed by changes based on political preferences. Mm-hmm. So you have to have really good reason to change rules. It's the view of the state and myself and a lot of other people that there was no logical reason to repeal the net neutrality rules. And so we'll be joining that lawsuit. There's also discussions underway and various groups being formed to talk about what are our legislative options, what can we do with respect to laws we can pass here in Connecticut, and that gets into an issue of what's called preemption. There, you know, sometimes when the federal government implements a massive regulatory scheme that's meant to preempt or prevent any further action by the states, we get into questions of what we can or cannot do, but we're going to push really hard and figure out what we can do. And then we're continuing to work at Congress, the congressional level, at the federal level. Congress can change these rules. Congress can say, no, we want net neutrality as a rule. And there is a minority, but a vocal and hopefully growing minority that says, no, the American public wants net neutrality rules. Congress should pass that, make that a law, and that'll avoid this question of whether the FCC, you know, is the right agency to decide whether our internet is open and free.
Yeah, and Connecticut's delegation is pretty much all on board with that.
That is my understanding, yeah.
Yeah, very good. Learned a lot, Ellen, as I always do when we get to chat, and I appreciate you taking so much time and coming on, not only helping me, but particularly all the folks that are listening or who are going to podcast in on the program when they hear that it's going to be talking about this net neutrality issue. And thank you for your advocacy, and you're taking a fast point on this issue following the repeal of net neutrality rules back in December. Consumer Counsel Ellen Swanson Katz is our guest this morning. If you'd like to learn more about what she does and what her small but mighty agency does for consumers and businesses here in Connecticut, you can go to ct.gov/OCC for the Office of Consumer Counsel. Ellen, Happy New Year. Thank you so much, and we'll be talking to you again soon. All right. We're wrapping up the program here, our first For the People broadcast of the new year, appropriately welcoming not just a new friend to the program, but a new radio station that we're broadcasting on. Yes, we're now going to be heard on a couple of stations in New Haven, including the new 102.3 Mod. So welcome, New Haven, if you're listening to that station. We're glad to be here for you. And our brand new friend on the program with us today is got some exciting news about an activity that's going to be happening in New Haven. We'll be talking about that in just a few minutes with Chris George. He's executive director of IRIS, Connecticut's largest refugee resettlement agency. IRIS stands for Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services. Chris, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
So we've got this really exciting opportunity for folks to get involved with the Run for Refugees, which is coming up on February 4th in New Haven. Many, many people come out for this, and it's a fantastic fundraiser. This is the 11th annual Run for Refugees, and we'll be talking about that and letting folks know how to get involved. But if you're listening and you'd like to register, you can go to IRISCT.org/run-for-refugees, and that'll take you right to the direct information, or you can just go to IRISCT.org to learn more about the organization, or you can just stick with us and listen to Chris George. Chris, if you wouldn't mind just reminding people exactly what IRIS Connecticut is all about.
Sure. So we are a refugee resettlement agency, and what that means is that the refugees who have been selected and vetted, and I mean like really sort of taken through the mill and vetting process overseas and then invited to come to the United States, some of those refugees come to Connecticut and are resettled by IRIS. So our job is to help refugees. So these are persecuted people from all over the world, to help them arrive safely and get off to a good start. We find apartments, we furnish it with donated furniture, stock the kitchen with food, we meet them at the airport when they arrive, we give them a nice hot meal soon after they arrive, we connect them to healthcare, we enroll the kids in school, we help parents learn English, and we help them find jobs. We get a little bit of money from the federal government, and then we also have to do a lot of private fundraising to make ends meet here. But it is, it is this country's oldest and most noble tradition, welcoming refugees from, it's the Statue of Liberty. And it is happening right here in your backyard, all across the state of Connecticut. Community groups have stepped forward to say, we want to welcome refugees in our community. Mm-hmm. It's really been something that we can be proud of. The number of individual volunteers and community groups that have said, we want to participate in this great American tradition and help save lives and get people off to a good start.
Well, for so long in this country, the folks that were resettling, the refugees and immigrants that were coming here, were so many of them were coming for the promise of a better life, for employment, a better home for their families. But it seems like today, at least when we hear a lot about immigrants and refugees, we're hearing about people who are, kind of more going back to the days of the pilgrims. They're fleeing oppression or the direct threat of violence or death to them and their loved ones.
That's right.
Have you seen, the numbers of people who have been utilizing your agency services shifting a little bit more from people who just want a better life to people who are running away from danger?
Mm-hmm. Well, the definition of a refugee is someone who was forced to flee their home country because of persecution. Mm-hmm. So those are the people that this government interviews and then runs through a security vetting process and then invites to come. There are other immigrants who come to this country who have not been fleeing persecution. We work almost exclusively with refugees. Recently, a lot have been coming from Afghanistan. We're getting many families of Afghans who worked with U.S. troops in Afghanistan. And when you work with U.S. troops in a place like Afghanistan, and the terrorist groups find out about it, you and your family is in danger. So our government has been bringing those families to the United States, and many of them have come to New Haven recently. We've been welcoming them here.
With that in mind, Connecticut really seems to be a bright light across the nation in terms of its consistency and in the comprehensive way and the immediate way it has reacted to some actions to stem the flow of individuals, even if they're running from potentially deadly situations in their home countries. Can you talk a little bit more deeply about how Connecticut is doing compared to not just other neighboring states here in New England, but across the country?
Right. Well, you could say that it starts at the top. A couple of years ago, when refugee resettlement became a little controversial, the presidential campaign was heating up, and some horrible things were being said about refugees. A number of governors from across the country said, we don't want to welcome refugees from Syria. Our governor, Molloy, stepped forward and said, we will welcome refugees from all over the world who have been vetted by the State Department and Department of Homeland Security, regardless of their nationality. This is what we do as Americans, and this is what we do as residents of Connecticut. And he was totally in step with the communities from across the state, whether they're churches or synagogues or mosques or rotary clubs or universities or colleges. Around the same time, they were saying to us, how can we welcome refugees? Yes, we want to donate. Yes, we want to contribute financially. Yes, we want to contribute used furniture. But we also would like to do something hands-on with refugees. Can you train us how to help a family get off to a new start? And we'll do it in our neighborhood. We'll find an apartment. We'll furnish it. We'll welcome the family at the airport. Mm-hmm. We, as volunteers, will enroll the kids in school, help them learn English. And that's been happening at an incredible pace. We've had almost 50 community groups resettle more than 60 refugee families over the past couple of years, mm-hmm. all across the state.
Yeah.
Now we want to celebrate all of this and, of course, raise a little money with a Run for Refugees Super Bowl Sunday morning. It's February 4th, Super Bowl Sunday morning. You're going to be doing a lot of unhealthy stuff in the evening while you watch the game. You want to do something healthy in the morning.
Get an
Come
edge.
Out, run, right. Come out, run, walk,
burn
stand
your,
up for
burn
refugees.
Burn your calories early.
That's right. Exactly.
Good. Where is this, where do people converge to start the race?
Well, it'll be in New Haven at the Wilbur Cross High School in New Haven. The race starts at 10. You want to get there, you know, much before 10. You want to get there early. Go online now and register so that, you're not blocked out. We had 2,500 people last year.
Mm-hmm.
That is more than we've ever had. And we're headed towards similar numbers this year.
Yeah. Well, it's huge fun for racers when they're in that massive pack. When you get numbers like you're talking about, it's not just speaks to the cause, but it's also incredible for each individual participant that's involved. Sort of that cliched sense of being a part of something bigger. So we want folks to come out and run for refugees. IRISCT.org is their website. If you go there, You'll immediately see the big ad and click through for the Run for Refugees if you'd like to get involved and run. But Chris George, who is the executive of IRIS, the Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services, IRIS, in the few moments that we have left with you, Chris, we do want to go back to something that you had said earlier as folks are kind of tuning in here. The majority of the refugees that are getting cleared for relocation and that are coming here to Connecticut, these are people who put themselves and their entire families, extended families in many cases, at great peril to not only help the United States in its goal to promote freedom and democracy throughout the world, but in so many cases, they have made an individual difference in protecting the lives of our armed service members and our allies in many of these countries. Right?
That's true. They serve as interpreters and aides to U.S. troops, not just in Afghanistan but also in Iraq. You can't exist in those countries unless you have local people that you can depend on. Many of them risked their lives. Many of them lost their lives. Many of them were killed while they waited to get approval to come to the United States.
Great.
So it is the least we can do for people who have risked so much.
Chris George of IRIS, the Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Service, Connecticut's largest refugee resettlement initiative, IRISCT.org is the website. If you'd like to get in before they close registration for the Run for Refugees, head to that website now and register. It's coming up on Super Bowl Sunday, February 4th here in New Haven. Chris, great to meet you, and thank you so much for your work and your agency's work as well. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.